Welcome to the CFO Playbook, where we bring you insights and strategies on how the many obstacles facing the heads of finance functions internationally are being tackled. I'm your host, Francois Bardenost. I'm the UK content lead at Soldo. And in each episode, we help you grow your team, your company, and yourself. Today, we welcome Andy Dean. Andy is the CFO at Eaton Futures, providing high-quality, person-centered care for people with disabilities and special needs. At Eaton Futures, Andy is at the intersection of finance, politics, and social policy. And actually, it's this tricky balance that Andy loves about his job. But of course, it's also a challenge. In this episode, Andy provides us with an extremely valuable on-the-ground perspective on the challenges faced by social care in the UK. And he also tells us his thoughts on why CFOs should be up to date with political events. We also chat about efficiency, helping carers focus on what actually matters, that is care, and so much more. So let's get into it. Enjoy, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on whichever medium you use. And we're joined now on the podcast by Andy Dean, the CFO of Eaton Futures. Welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Good to be here, Fran.
What brought you into healthcare? I looked at your CV a little bit earlier on LinkedIn, and you seem to have a sort of like extensive kind of background in this sector. What exactly is it about this area of our economy that seems to draw you in?
It was, I guess, coincidental in a sense that, as you've seen, I trained at KPMG, spent 6 years there. And then back end of those 6 years, I decided where I wanted to get to was CFO rather than stay in KPMG and try and make partner. And therefore, set a career path in the roles outside KPMG that sort of might suit that career trajectory towards CFO. And then it was coincidence in a sense that then the right role came up at Craigmore, which is another social care provider, as you say. Yeah, and then got into it there. Other than 1 year out, the last 13 years I've spent in the social care sector across three companies. I guess, why have I stayed? A combination of the right people. My CFO at my second company was the CFO at Craigmore, so I guess I followed him a bit. And then actually, it's just a really fascinating sector to work in. You know, it's coincided with austerity here in the UK, I guess. So I'm sure we'll go on to lots of challenges coincided with COVID. And obviously, we were fairly impacted by that in different ways. And I guess what I really like about it is that it's relevant to most people you speak to. Most people that you speak to about what do you do, they can relate to having a relative in some kind of care. It's just become a fascinating sector.
It's a very unique hybrid, like you say, between obviously private sector, but there's a sort of core social mission that's there. I mean, lots of companies kind of talk about, you know, having a mission, do X and all this stuff. But I mean, I suppose, is it nice to have that clarity of like precisely what it is that you're here to do?
I think that the fact that, you know, we make decisions every single day that impact and benefit the people that we support. And we've got hundreds of stories of service users who live more independent having been supported by us than previously. So Eaton Futures supports 670 service users that have either a mental health, a learning disability, or live with autism. And so often they come out of hospital, they after a period of years, and then we help them over a period of time to live independent, where they can go to the shops on their own, maybe get a job. And I think that that creates a massive sense of achievement and for the company. And also it does give you, when you're going through the numbers and the management accounts month in, month out, I personally believe that it gives you a much greater sense of fulfillment in what the company do. And you say the values that the company exudes.
You mentioned there like about the numbers, which I mean, obviously that is now a very, very, very big part of what it is you do. Is there a bit of a tension. It could be like a healthy tension, but a tension between like that social mission that you have and the numbers at the end of the day? Is it something that you have to kind of try and balance and make work and make them kind of gel together nicely?
I guess so, to a certain extent. I think that we are 100% public funded because of the service users that we support. We're either local authority or NHS funded. And that creates its own level of challenge through the years of austerity. The pricing has come under pressure. And I guess then through the numbers, there is a, sometimes through tenders and what have you, you have to cost out where you're at. I think importantly, it's actually being transparent with local authority commissioners, with the NHS, when they challenge that, that look, yes, we are a company. We do make a degree of profit, but we also from that support a huge number of service users, as I say, lead increasingly independent lives. And the commissioners get that most of the time.
And it's very interesting, like the positioning that Care is in, because like you say, obviously Eden Futures is a private company, but there is a public component to it. You do deal with like public authorities and so on. How much, as CFO of Eden Futures, do you kind of partake in that? How much do you deal with sort of local authorities and so on? Or is that sort of left to other people in the company?
I guess it depends. So am I dealing with the local authorities every day? No, but certainly from time to time when the need arises to escalate, maybe we've got a particular problem in relation to the level of occupancy in one of our properties, or there's queries in relation to our fee rates, then yeah, that's when I get involved. And sometimes then also when we're looking at growth and new properties and going to talk to the local authorities then about the opportunities.
Yeah, very interesting. So you've kind of referenced the challenges aspect within social care in the UK. You look at the press, you read the newspapers or whatever, and then there's a sort of very kind of broad strokes, lacking in nuance kind of thing, like, yeah, social care is in crisis. But the question I would ask is, and it'd be interesting to get your perspective on this as someone who actually operates in the sector. What exactly is the state of the sector at the moment? Is it in crisis? And if it is a crisis, what exactly is this crisis comprised of?
So I guess probably we've been talking about social care crisis in the UK for the last 6, 7, 8 years. And at times you sort of felt like you're getting over the other side of one part of it. So through 2015, 2016, 2017, it was the fee rates that were coming under increasing pressure. And then we moved through to COVID. And then we moved through to the post-COVID staffing crisis. So where are we today? I think we are in a crisis in that there are still thousands of people in hospital in long-term stays, either older people waiting for older people care, or in our part of the sector, people living with autism and or a learning disability or mental health illness who have been in hospital for a long time, where there's just not the number or appropriate placements in the community to be supported in social care. That is the greatest crisis, that there are people in hospital today that, if there were the right places, could be living in the community. The staffing crisis is still there. It has got better over the last 12, 15 months, undoubtedly. The 6 months or so after COVID were really tough.
Why has that improved?
I think it's multifaceted. Part of it is that I think the sector has got better at recruiting. Part of it, I think, is the cost of living crisis. You know, people getting second jobs, moving sectors to one that is safer. You know, the one side of COVID that was a positive for the sector was it showed people, both frankly investors and employees, that the social care sector is resilient in terms of financing. So I think there's probably a bit of that. And then increasingly providers are looking to other channels. So a number of providers have started to recruit from overseas. It's been in the news recently.
So that's interesting. So the recruiting from overseas aspect, is that because obviously we've kind of gone through this whole process here in the UK of leaving the European Union, which closed off a quite big labor market for us, for many companies. So you say companies are delving back into the sort of international labor pool again. Is Eden Futures doing something similar? And how do you kind of go around these new hurdles that have been brought in around the labor market?
We have started to do it in this year, yes. We have started, we have brought a number of colleagues have joined us from India. It's complex. The rules are incredibly complex. You have to apply for sponsorship licenses and certificates of sponsorship. And we have a partner that we work with to do that. So it is complicated. It is relatively expensive, but it has opened up another channel of recruitment that wasn't there. So the government last year put support workers on the shortage occupation list, which has allowed employers to recruit under the Tier 2 sponsorship regime that is in place.
That's really interesting. And like, how involved are you in something like that also in terms of setting that up? And I guess there is a cost allocation element to something like that.
Yeah, so CFO, I guess it's, again, number of different ways. So CFO often gets involved from the sort of legal contractual negotiation perspective, and I looked at it from there. As you say, from a cost modelling perspective, actually, what is the payback from, if you compare the bringing a support worker in from overseas as compared to using the agency worker in the UK? I was involved heavily, and you know, I think that's part of the great thing about being a CFO, I think, is that you do get involved in all different areas of the business.
Yeah, it's so varied, isn't it? Yeah, it really is the sort of multi-tool of, I guess, modern companies these days. Like, I mean, this podcast, I'm lucky to speak to all kinds of CFOs. And it's crazy the breadth of different tasks and different people that they deal with. And I suppose that's something that you have to be comfortable with and be kind of drawn to a certain extent these days, if you want to be CFO.
I think that's right. You know, part of your role is that wide base of stakeholders. You can be talking to your shareholder one day, you can be talking to your lender another day, you can be talking to your insurer. You know, CFOs like me are often responsible for the IT, so get involved in the IT discussions, talking to our customers, so in our case our commissioning partners, around whatever issue it might be, say fee rates, occupancy, and then you know, get involved with the lawyers on contractual side. So yes, it is a varied role. No, you know, the old adage that no day is ever the same is absolutely right from a CFO perspective.
Especially in a sector like care, which is also anyways, because it just involves people and people with complex needs, it's already quite varied. So then you add that on top, I can imagine, on a day-to-day basis. I'm surprised you don't have like whiplash.
Yeah, and then I can be, you know, I often go out and see some of our services, talk to our support staff, talk to our managers, find out what the issues are that they're facing, how we can help overcome them to make their lives in supporting our service users easier.
You referenced IT there, which obviously kind of folds into tech and technology more broadly. I'm interested to hear your perspective on technology, how it's applied in social care, and how it can be used more effectively. Because from my understanding is that I think it's something that social care has perhaps lagged in a little bit. Many care companies are slightly lo-fi.
I think that's absolutely right. So I think we have lagged. Over the last years, we've sort of been investing in various different elements of technology. We've put in a rotoring system that then allows us to make payroll payments on the back of that, to take out manual timesheets. We've put in a new incident reporting system. So clearly from the social care sector is highly regulated, quite rightly. So one of the things that we need to be able to do is identify where incidents occur, identify trends, where there's risk factors, and what we can do to mitigate those. And then the next phase that we're about to do is currently every one of our service users has a paper care file, which can be 40, 50, 60 pages thick in cases. So over the next 12 months, we're looking at taking those electronic. The NHS and the government have got a project on. I think they're trying to get 80% of providers onto electronic care records over the next couple of years. So we're taking part in that exercise. So that's the next significant investment in both time and money.
What do these sorts of investments mean for you and for other sort of people that are in the operational side of the business? Does it save you a lot of time?
I think it's the data, isn't it? And, you know, I've seen CFOs referred as chief data officers in places. And I think that is the big play from my perspective and the rest of the management team. It's the getting a richer level of data that we can then use to operate the business more efficiently and safer, frankly. You know, the more data we have about what's going on in the business, the more that we can react to it and create better environments for the people that we support.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, efficiency, because it is a bit of a win-win, really, because, I mean, obviously, it's an avenue for you to get more for your investments without sort of compromising, and in many respects, actually improving the care that service users get. Is that the way you view it too? Is that a very important thing that you focus on, is like maximizing efficiencies?
So the supported living part of the sector that we operate in is a bit different in that we get paid a set amount for every hour of support that we provide. So in many senses, there isn't a, well, can we support people more efficiently because actually we get paid for the care hours that we provide. Where we look to, I guess, in this area is, ironically, our success story from supporting a service user is actually that they need less support from us. So we actually reduce our fees as we work with the service user in aiding them live a more independent life. But that then is then the, going back to the commissioner, is a success story that, look, when this service user came in, we were maybe supporting them 1-to-1, 24 hours a day. And we're now only supporting them 5 hours a day. And that has had this cost benefit to you. You're paying us less money. And therefore, we want to open up a new service and do this great work again. And that is the success story from our perspective. If you like, gross margin level, clearly at a, you know, at a bottom line EBITDA margin level, then always we are trying to do more with, you know, the same or less operating costs. But from a pure gross margin support level, it's really about building that top line by being as great as you can be at delivering care and support and then shouting about it so that you can support more people.
You've, I guess, alluded to it a little bit there around, and just to backtrack a little bit, we talked about employees and staff. How much is employee retention something that you focus on? And how much power does the CFO actually have on making employees stay with the company longer?
So it's an interesting one, is it? Does something I do today mean a support worker in one of our services will stay with us longer? Directly, possibly not. But where I have increasingly got involved since the staffing crisis commenced is looking at it from a data perspective and actually going into that granular detail of, clearly we look at attrition every month, but actually, is there services where that attrition is higher? Identifying that and then being that business partner to our operation colleagues to say, look, that service there, that property there, our attrition is double that somewhere else. And everything else we know about that area has similar characteristics. So there must be something going on there that means that that has led to attrition being higher. And delving into, as we've gone into as much detail as well, why is that area we've recruited six people there, and of those six, five have left in 6 months. I'm making up these stats for the record. But why is, there must be something either through the recruitment process or the induction process or in the job that is causing that. So it is around using that data and then working as the partner to the operations to say, right, let's try and work this through and see whether we can improve things.
Another point that you referenced was around austerity, which obviously has to do with, what happens at the ballot box, in terms of politics and so on. How much, as the CFO of a social care company, do you have to kind of keep abreast of what's happening at the sort of Westminster level and different governments have different perspectives and different ideas around funding social care and so on. So is that something that you kind of worry about and look at, or is it something that you kind of just deal with as it comes?
No, I think it is very much something that I keep aware of. And I think it probably, to come back to that first question of yours, it's one of the reasons why I enjoy working in the sector, because I've always been quite interested in politics, and therefore actually working in a sector where politics directly impacts it so directly is actually one of the reasons why I really enjoy it. So yeah, need to keep abreast of what's going on. Clearly at the moment we are looking at what the Labour Party's policies are in this area. You know, given that the odds are at the moment they will be looking at a change in government over the next 12 to 18 months. So yes, it's vital that we're aware that, and that's built into, you know, anything that we're thinking about there is considered in terms of our planning, our risk matrix and that sort of thing. So I think it's vital for a CFO in this sector.
There's obviously the current various uncertainties. You know, I'm thinking about the energy crisis, the cost of living crisis, so many crises, whatever the plural of that is. Yeah. How is that affecting Eden Futures at the moment? I guess cost of living is probably something that really affects your employees and so on. And energy-wise, I'm interested to actually hear about how that has also affected you guys.
So interestingly, the way supported living works is that the service users live in their own house and they get full benefits, but are then responsible for their own energy costs. So we haven't been as directly impacted by the energy crisis, albeit what we have had to do is make sure that our teams, our support worker teams, are fully aware of what aid is available, what grants and what have you are available to assist with our support, assist our service users with their utility costs, assist in making sure lights are turned off, heating's turned down, that sort of thing. So I guess it hasn't been that direct financial cost, but actually in terms of making sure that information's available and for both employees and support workers has been one of our focuses through it.
Yeah, very interesting. And one of the things that I think about, and it'll be interesting to ask you this one, is obviously there's a whole array of things that needs to be done to make the social care sector, I guess, more resilient and improve its kind of like foundational strength moving into the future. But is there something that you think is a fix that could be done relatively quickly that would make a big difference to the social care sector? And if yes, what is that?
The reality, I think, is the quick fixes have been done. What is actually required is that the Holy Grail, really. And, you know, that becomes very difficult because you need a very stable political environment to do it in, is the long-term social care reform. Going back to, clearly, we've been through 10 years of various proposals and uncertainty around what's going to happen with older people care. Currently, when if you require care in an older people's home, you have to pay for it up to about, when you get to about £25,000 of assets, I think it is, which is obviously not a lot. So various governments have come up with proposals for a cap on that. I think it was mentioned about £80,000-£100,000 of care costs that you would pay, but that would be incredibly expensive. There was a national insurance went up with a long-term aim of funding that, but that now has come back down. That was part of Liz Truss's tax cuts that remained. So longer-term social care proposals are still stuck, frankly, and that's not going to change this time, this side of the election. So we'll have to see what happens the other side. I do think that is the key, but it's not easy. And it's expensive at the end of the day. And then what should in theory be quicker, but the Holy Grail that social care providers have always been seeking is a far more joined up approach between the local authorities and the NHS. So depending on the health needs of the service users, some of our service users are funded through the NHS, some are funded through local authorities. It's very disjointed, which can mean discharge takes inordinate amounts of time, and isn't always done as well as can be done in terms of making sure that care providers have all the information they need to be able to provide the right support to the service user. That should be the easier bit, if you like, because that is structural rather than financial. But again, we've been talking about that for 10, 15 years and various proposals have come and gone. The most recent ones came in last year and I think they're still bedding down. So we'll see what happens.
Andy, I have to take issue with the fact that you've implied that the UK hasn't had a stable political environment. Frankly, I just I think it's absurd that you would say something like this. We've been a model of political stability. Andy, it's been really fascinating speaking to you. Just as a closing point, I often ask my guests some kind of question that's, I guess, a little bit more reflective on their career. Can you tell me about a mentor that you had and your trajectory towards CFO that was particularly important to you?
So yeah, so as I said, I've worked for the CFO in my previous business, who I've worked for in another business as well, was someone that, yes, was a line manager, but was very much a mentor for me. He supported me through my development. I guess the key things from my point of view was he would always tell me when I got it wrong, as well as when I get it right, and gain that constructive, timely feedback, I think is vital as you develop. Then it's the way that you as an individual take that on board and learn from it. He helped me plot the route where he saw gaps in my knowledge, in my development, that he felt would prevent me getting to CFO. He helped to unlock those. So suggested I help in negotiation a contract or look focus on a particular area, and you know, absolutely vital in getting to where I am today, frankly.
Is it something that you try to do now as someone who has risen to the level of CFO?
Yeah, I do. I think developing people is critical in this day and age where competition for staff in back office functions like finance, as well as that support worker base, is challenging, and therefore actually offering people the opportunities to develop and identifying what they need to develop to the next phase doesn't cost anything, does it? But actually what you get back as they develop, and actually the sense of loyalty that you get from them, it doesn't cost anything, but it's vital. And it's also vital, especially where, you know, we are a growing business. We want to continue to grow, support more service users. And part of that is that we need to grow our teams with it, both in terms of the number of people, but also the abilities of the people within those teams.
And just final question, which is, would you recommend social care as a viable and rewarding sector to work in for any aspiring finance professionals?
I would. I've absolutely loved the 12 years I've spent in the sector. I think that it's been fascinating. I think it is a sector that you do get this sense of reward from. You go to work and at the end of the day, you know what you're doing has an indirect impact on helping our support workers deliver great care to individuals. And that is so rewarding. And actually, you know, from a finance team perspective, our aim is always, you know, let's make sure we get support workers paid correctly and on time, because that's key. Make sure that we support our team managers, our area managers, in order that we make their lives as easy as we possibly can, in order that they can focus on the most important part of their job, which is ensuring we deliver great care. That's almost the outputs, if you like. But then from a actual sector to work in, as I say, I think that particularly if you have that interest in the wider economy, what goes on in the world, it's great to actually be able to work in a sector that is relevant, that when you go and talk to a friend about what you do, you can have pride in what you do, and actually they can see the relevance, because often they've had a grandmother or grandfather or whoever that's been in care and actually can relate to what you do.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I suppose if you're like working in some kind of abstract deeply financialized sector. People kind of just glaze over when you speak to them about your work. But, you know, like social care, like you say, like everyone has a grandma, everyone knows someone who is in care or needs care. So yeah, it must be very rewarding in that way. Andy Dean, it's been fantastic speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time. Is there anywhere that people can connect with you online? Do you blog? Do you tweet? Is that something you do?
Mainly through LinkedIn, Francie, yeah. So I do have a Twitter account, but I'm more of a watcher rather than a tweeter. But yeah, LinkedIn's best place.
Connect with Andy on LinkedIn if you'd like to say hello and connect with him. But yeah, thank you very much for your time, Andy. Much appreciated, and have a good day.
Thanks, Fran. Been great to catch up.
This show is brought to you by Soldo, the brighter way to manage business spending and expenses. With Soldo, you can control every expense, track spend in real time, automate financial reporting, and then use those insights to fuel your growth. Learn more at soldo.com.